Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of April. The question this hour is, should fraternities be abolished? The conversation today was prompted by something actually that Robert Reich said, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He's been around universities for much of his life and teaches at UC Berkeley. He expressed this view on the Larry Wilmore, The Nightly Show, that college fraternities should be abolished. He says, for the most part, fraternities are elitist, exclusive, and privileged. They have nothing to do with higher education, and they're periodically mired in scandal involving hazing, the University of Wisconsin-Madison's fraternities, degrading hazing, racism, the video of Sigma Alpha Epsilon members calling for the lynching of African Americans, sexual assault, University of Maryland frat brothers' pro-rape remarks, allegations of drug dealing and sexual assault in a North Carolina state fraternity, degradation of women. The list goes on, he says, and it's just in the last few months. Some say boys will be boys. If they're not in a fraternity, they'll do all of this somewhere else. He says, rubbish. A much-cited 2007 study, confirmed by other studies, shows fraternity members are 300% more likely to commit rape than non-affiliated students. We're going to be talking about fraternities, and I guess the question of the hour, and we're interested in your response, is whether or not they should be abolished. Our two guests have written extensively. Our first guest this hour spent a year doing an investigation of Greek houses, and she wrote a piece for The Atlantic, which looks at the history of fraternities and what they've been accused of and how they cover for themselves and how they exist apart from the general administration of a university. And later we'll be speaking with a reporter for Vox. Caitlin Flanagan is our first guest, began her magazine writing career in 2001. And she wrote specifically about modern domestic life as it is lived by professional class women. She has been a social critic and takes on self-indulgence, political correctness. She has written for The Atlantic, also for, she has been a finalist for the National Magazine Award many times, and she has written for other publications as well. She is the author of To Hell with All of That, an exploration based on her Atlantic articles on the lives of modern women. Later in the hour, Libby Nelson, who covers education for Vox, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Here is how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that is @KDunnShow. Caitlin Flanagan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What is it that prompted you to do this very lengthy study? You spent a year investigating fraternities in this country.
Well, it was interesting hearing you talk about the Robert Reich quote. My father was a professor at Berkeley when I was growing up, and he was an academic and an intellectual, and he didn't have any time for fraternities at all. He just sort of thought they were anti-intellectual places. And then I was interested in them, and I went to college at the University of Virginia, actually, with a huge Greek system.
Mm.
And the whole system I found extremely interesting. It was simultaneously a very dangerous place for young women when I went to school there, and a very alluring and attractive place for young women and young men. And it was coming from Berkeley, which had the first school, the first public school district in the country to integrate without a court order, to go to Virginia in the 1980s and to see that there were these two separate systems of fraternities, one for white kids and one for black kids. I thought, you know, it was hard to believe that it was the second half of the 20th century. So everything about them fascinated me. And I was particularly interested in how, given that they're so not modern, you know, the future of America is multi-ethnic, it's multiracial, it's mixing of genders, not separation of genders. I was really interested in how the institution could be getting stronger and stronger and stronger as the years go by, instead of weaker, and what did it reflect, and who did it represent, and who's proud to call themselves fraternity members. All those things were just really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. I had no idea, as you say in your article in The Atlantic, that they emanated in part from the Freemasons, of which George Washington himself was a member.
They're really old. That's one of the interesting things. You know, a lot of the symbols, you know, the skull at some places, the key at some places, the triangle, the level, all these things are Freemasonry symbols, and that's what they grew out of. And what was so interesting to me is that sometimes those of us who question fraternities will sort of think that, oh, they're this sort of blight on American higher education, or they're an addition to it, they're some extra thing added on to it. In fact, they're so deeply into the groundwater of American higher education that we probably wouldn't have the system we have today without fraternities. The massive expansion of higher education in the late 19th century would never have happened if there weren't fraternities to provide so much housing, and also to help provide an idea that higher education, which was, you know, mostly exclusively for men at that point, that was a worthwhile thing for sort of a red-blooded American man to do. It wasn't just future ministers who were going to pore over their religious texts who were going to go to college, that sort of a red-blooded American man who was going to enter the world of business or politics or law, he too could go to college, and it would be in no way sort of a feminizing experience, which was what was kind of the fear about college in the 19th century.
And what about the oversight? Is there oversight either in the laws of the university or the college and fraternities? Do they make sure that there's no underage drinking? Do they have a set of laws looking at, you know, appropriate sexual conduct in these places? Are they overseen by any adults?
Well, remember, in the modern world, the modern university world since, you know, the 1960s, the university itself doesn't have much oversight at all in any aspect of the private lives of its students. You know, going away to college, especially as a young woman, you know, before the mid-60s, it was much more like going away to boarding school is now. There were curfews, people knew where you were, there was a dorm mother, there was contact with your parents. The contract for the hall education wasn't between you as an 18-year-old adult and the university, it was between your parents and the university, who were operating the university was operating as your parents. And all that's gone now, and nothing really replaced it. You know, there is no sense of supervision. If kids are going to have a party off campus in an apartment, the university isn't going to send over a chaperone, you know, a monitor.
Right.
And these fraternity houses, legally, they're privately owned structures. Usually they're on privately held land. And there is no real right in most situations for the university to provide oversight. Where the trouble comes in is, you know, the contemporary American young person, the late teen who goes off to college, the kid who goes to a residential college, a four-year residential college, soup to nuts, boarding, you know, dining hall and all that, they've been pretty cosseted their whole lives. They've probably had some kind of helicopter parents. They're pretty used to the idea that somewhere out there there's supervision over me. They really think that maybe they've been to summer camp. Maybe they've even been to a college program over the summer. What they didn't realize was all those other experiences, they were minors, and so there was supervision.
Mm-hmm.
So they get to college, and they just see the fraternities, and they kind of in the back of their mind think there's some real grown-up looking after this, and there really isn't in most cases. And in a good fraternity house, very above board, there are excellent fraternity chapters all over the country. In a bad fraternity house, it is essentially a criminal operation with everything from planned sexual assault to drug dealing to the inflicted trauma of hazing. And there's no way for a young undergraduate to know which are the good chapters on their campus and which are the bad ones. They have to rely on the lore and the talk, and sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not, and it's kind of a rumor mill to find out where you can go that's safe and where isn't in terms of the fraternities on campus.
And is there something about the last few months or the last couple of years that you've been investigating so fully here that is showing us that the amount of sexual violence, the rapes that are taking place, the horrendous songs of racism, the hazing, has all of that become worse, Caitlin?
Fraternities are larger than ever, and whenever there's more fraternities, there's more problems. There's a huge appetite for fraternity life right now, which you can make a lot of things out of. In terms of hazing, a side point there I would say is we've been at war in one way or another for a long time in America, and hazing in this country in fraternities always tracks our life at war. It was after the Civil War that young men who felt very guilty that they hadn't taken part in that great event that their fathers and even their brothers had sorrowed and lost so much life and health through, that hazing began to become much more serious. It was after the Second World War that it became explicitly militaristic in nature. So I would say there may be some crossover there, a sense that you have to prove yourself in some way through physical pain and through a real chain of command and a real sense of where you stand in the pecking order. Sexual assault, more people are talking about it than did before. But I can tell you, I'm 53. I went to college a long time ago. My friends, I knew women who were absolutely sexually assaulted in those fraternity houses, and our university president would go there and have sherry at the university houses. It was almost like, and that hasn't changed. It was this idea that here are places officially recognized by our university that our own president would go and visit, and this happens all over the country to this day, and everybody kind of knows a young woman could be very easily raped upstairs, and sometimes it's a planned event. It's not like the Rolling Stone event. Never saw anything like that in a year of studying this and 30 years of talking and thinking about it. But rapes absolutely take place in a lot of those houses.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of racism, I must say, I guess I sometimes think better of the country than I should. But those songs that were sung about lynching, I was just astounded. My jaw dropped open when I heard that news report. Are you serious? This is being sung now?
You know, the weird reaction to that from the fraternity was, you know, we're going to have some sensitivity training. And then the young man who led it said, gee, I never thought of myself as a racist.
Right.
And I thought, you know, we've all had moments where we've realized we've had some unexplored issue or, you know, we haven't had self-awareness in one area or another. But if you are running a prestigious private club that you will not let African Americans join, you have a song that says you don't let them join that uses the N-word, and you think it's a big joke to say you'd rather lynch them than let them join, and you think maybe a sensitivity session is going to help with that? And this is where I think when we talk about the possibility of ever abolishing these fraternities, remember, you know, I'm a white woman. I have two white kids getting ready to go to college. It's as exciting and full of hope and pride as it is to send your kids to college, the main thing as a mom you wonder is, you know, am I sending my child to the right place? Is my child going to be accepted? Is my child going to make friends? Imagine if you had an African-American son. You send him off to this university, and you find out you've sent your child someplace where there's a prestigious private club that he cannot even approach for friendship because his skin is black in 2015, and that our tax dollars are helping to support that club. You know, it's pretty outrageous. It's pretty outrageous, and I think that's where the Bill of Particulars is going to come due, in the fact that you and I support these organizations with tax dollars.
You write in your piece, the powerful and well-funded political action committee that represents fraternities in Washington has fought successfully to ensure that freedom of association language is included in all higher education reauthorization legislation, thus disallowing public universities the ability to ban fraternities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't. People talk about abolishing fraternities. I just use the term myself. You can't do it because certainly at a public university, the saying in legal and higher ed law is the Constitution doesn't stop at the college gates. You can't tell anybody who enrolls in college you can't belong to a private club. You can't tell them, oh, you've enrolled at the University of Wisconsin, you can't join the Sierra Club. You can't join an LGBT club. You know, you can't join these clubs because we don't like the club. You know, you can, if you're at a public university, you have a constitutionally protected right, the freedom of association. It's an implied right from the freedom of assembly. You have the right to belong to whatever club you want to belong to. So you cannot stop young men from having that right, nor should you. But what we can say as a matter of significant public interest is, should our universities be in contractual relationships with these organizations, and should these organizations benefit in so many different ways from nonprofit status in terms of taxing them, should they be allowed to have these protections and privileges when they're doing things like not letting anyone in who's African American, making up a chant over it, and singing about lynching?
We're going to welcome phone calls. Caitlin Flanagan is our guest, the first part of this show. The question is, although there may be some legal reasons this could not happen, but should fraternities be put out of existence in some way? Our guest has done a year-long study of fraternities, the Dark Power of Fraternities, a year-long investigation of Greek houses, reveals their endemic, lurid, and sometimes tragic problems, and a sophisticated system for shifting the blame. It appeared on in the Atlantic in March of 2014. What do you think? Should they be banned? If they could be banned, should they be banned? Do they serve any legitimate purpose? I'm sure that some of you listening, maybe many of you, were members of fraternities or sororities. For some, it's an experience of friendship. And as our guest says, in the best of fraternities and sororities, it may be a model of growth, a model of public service, et cetera. But the bad news that we've been hearing seems to be getting worse and worse and more frequent. So what do you think? Here's our phone number. We welcome your phone calls right now. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. To you in a moment, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're asking whether or not fraternities should be abolished in this country. And welcoming your phone calls, Emily in Oshkosh. Hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I never saw myself as being somebody involved in the Greek life on campus. And actually, after experiencing it on my campus, I would never have changed. I would always have gone back and done that. After being a part of the Greek life, I found how high some of the standards really were. So I know right now there's kind of a lot of negative news, but it's really overshadowing, I think, a lot of the Greek life students. And as I said, one of those things is if you are not at that standard, there's a lot of like programs that they help you to do your best. And then even behavioral standards. My sorority in particular, you know, there were specific times where if a member had done something kind of a little bit out of line or that made others comfortable, we had a forum to bring that up and to kind of create that change within our group. And I think even above and beyond that, we did a lot of community outreach. We were fundraising for victims of domestic violence in our civic space, but, you know, each free group.
Thank you very much. Your phone is a little scratchy, but we get the general idea. Caitlin.
Well, sororities and fraternities, very different organizations, so I would say that first. But I think she's raising a point that people will often bring up in defense of fraternities, which is that why are we focusing on these few incidents, relatively speaking? It's a vast system. And it does a great amount of good, particularly, as she mentioned, in the raising of money. Fraternity men raise a tremendous amount, many millions of dollars every year for different organizations. And why isn't that the story? My answer to that is the scope and nature of the problems that fraternities have. When fraternities have problems that we report on, it's not that, well, they're a great organization, but their house is a little messy and their parties are a little loud and their grade point average is a little low. We're not talking about that. We're talking about rape. We're talking about the inflicted trauma of hazing. We're talking about kids losing their lives to events at fraternity houses. So we're talking, and we're talking about an endemic kind of racism that bars people of non-white skin from joining a club that receives public dollars or public tax protections. So the problems are so large, and I always say these would still be terrible problems if they occurred in the military. But at least in the military, there's a sense that it's a very dangerous place and that people are engaged in this very important work of defending our country. And we could imagine that within that context, there would be problems on the order of violence and inflicted trauma that needed to be dealt with. But the idea that this is brought onto the college campus, which is supposed to be dedicated to education of young people, is quite shocking to people. And I think the system deserves the attention that it's getting right now. You know, if a bunch of stories suddenly came out that that librarians all across the country were being charged with raping students in the library, we'd say something's wrong with these librarians. Mm-hmm. You know, we would find some commonality and say here's an issue to work on. And the common thread between many, many very ghastly and heartbreaking stories is fraternity membership. So I think it is appropriate for the story to get this much coverage, although I will certainly confess there's a lurid nature to these stories that may lend them a disproportionate level of sort of engagement by the general public, because it's not so much about financial scandals as it is about healthy young people enduring sort of horrible fates. And I think the disproportionality here is focusing on what happens to, again, bringing race into it, to white privileged kids at college. You know, they may be getting more attention than, say, the equally or probably more harrowing thing that happened to low-income kids outside of the college world. So I think that might be reported on more, but I don't think there's anything disproportionate in the amount of attention the bad stories get as opposed to the good ones in fraternity life.
We also haven't mentioned the number of accidents, and you outlined those in your piece as well, that there's so many accidents you hear from drinking, people falling off balconies at fraternity houses around the country and being seriously injured or in some cases dying from excessive alcohol consumption and lack of railings. And I mean, a lot of that is pretty troublesome as well.
You know, college binge drinking really centers on two factors: being white and having college-educated parents. Anybody can and does drink heavily in college, but there's a real concentration, a real spike in the demographics around those two. And the third thing is being male. So you put those three things together, you're going to have a pretty big, the Venn diagram overlaps pretty significantly with fraternity membership. So a lot of what you're seeing at these houses is simply the result. When you get to the accidents, that doesn't have anything so much to do with the essential nature of fraternities as it does with the essential nature of blackout drinking. And I've, you know, been on a lot of colleges speaking lately, and kids talk pretty openly about just this idea that, again, as someone who's 53, it's something I have to really wrap my head around, the very intention of blackout drinking, that the intention is to get to a point that you have no memory of what happened the night before. And when that's the situation, of course you're going to have a huge amount of slip and fall accidents, you're going to have a huge amount of overconsumption accidents, alcohol poisoning accidents, and then just the kinds of things that happen in terms of assault and battery, you know, civil assault and sexual assault, when you have both parties in that event unable to, in a sense, the walking dead, you know, really the man has no right, I'm not saying he has any right to take any sexual act upon a woman who's equally blacked out, but it is much more common for that to happen when both of them are that drunk. And the colleges have thrown up their hands. They don't seem to have any answer to the alcohol problem, and that's central to the big problems we're seeing now.
Yes. Let's go next to William in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, William.
Yes, I was calling because I was a member of one of the fraternities in one of the southern states a long time ago. I'm about the same age as the author. And I just disagree with most of what she's saying. I found the fraternity experience to be excellent. It formed great friendships, and we did a lot of good things for the campus. Our grade point average was very high, higher than the non-fraternity members or non-Greek members. I don't think that the sexual part of the problem, I guess, with fraternities, that's a problem, I think, widely throughout every university. I mean, nowadays, not when I was in college, but they have co-ed dorms. I mean, you can go right next door to somebody of different sex. And I don't know. I think you're generalizing about fraternities and blaming a lot of problems with universities on fraternities. It disturbs me, quite frankly.
Well, what about the stories that have come up recently, William, about the racist songs that have been sung and the number of hazing problems and accidents and rapes that have taken place in fraternity houses in the country? Don't you find that of concern?
Well, there's one story about a racism which was horrible in Oklahoma, and I know exactly what you're talking about, and that's terrible, and I can't imagine what those kids were thinking, quite frankly. But that's kind of like saying that everybody from the South is a racist. I think that's ridiculous.
Well, I think you need to read her article, because it's more than just one incident, or you wouldn't have written about this, or people wouldn't be calling for fraternities to be abolished. There are lots of problems on many campuses, aren't there, Caitlin?
Yeah, I mean, he's you know, certainly raising good points. Fraternities are basically franchise operations with terrible quality control. So I have no doubt. I mean, he sounds like a, you know, an honest person, as far as I can tell from the medium, you know, that, you know, his chapter was probably a good chapter. There may have been a chapter of the same fraternity at the next university over from where he is that was the same fraternity, but was a terrible chapter. So individual testimony is valuable, but it does not invalidate the stories of extreme problems in the fraternities. And I would add to it, the SAE incident in Oklahoma, I would not say it's as isolated as he suggests. It's been revealed that those young men learned that chant on a national leadership cruise that took place last summer. So it wasn't as though it was some regional thing particular to that chapter at the University of Oklahoma. It was something they learned not in formal session, but in a vast national setting of their fraternity. So I don't think we can just, in terms of that song and that chant, and again, it would be one thing if they had, I would find the chant vile no matter what, but if it was a multiracial, multiethnic fraternity and they had that chant, I would say, okay, I guess you guys probably aren't racist in your membership policies, but this song is hideous, get rid of the song. But the song completely told us how they admitted members, because there were no African-American members in their club. So the song was telling us about the discriminatory practices that have resulted in an all-white club. So I think it's far more serious and far less isolated than the caller might suggest.
And Caitlin, thank you so much for being with us and for all your extensive work. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Caitlin Flanagan, her piece, The Dark Power of Fraternities, a year-long investigation of Greek houses reveals their endemic, lurid, and sometimes tragic problems and a sophisticated system for shifting the blame. Same topic. We're just changing guests at this point in time. Libby Nelson is with us now, and Libby has piece for Vox, Colleges Depend on Greek Life, and That's Why It Is So Hard to Control. She covers education for Vox. Before that, she covered federal policy, Congress, and religious colleges for Inside Higher Education, has worked as a reporter for the Times Tribune in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and as an intern at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Libby Nelson, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure. So what do you mean when you say colleges depend on Greek life? That's why it's hard to control. How do they depend on Greek life?
I think the popular conception of this is that members of fraternities and sororities, when they go on to be alumni, tend to donate, tend to be involved, tend to have a financial relationship with the university. And that's absolutely true. But that's really only the surface of the way that colleges and fraternities and sororities are intertwined. They provide housing for students who otherwise colleges might have to house. And they, especially at universities where they're very prominent, they really play a big role in social life. And, you know, colleges want to attract students. They want to prove that they have a social scene. And in some ways, they've sort of outsourced the building of that social scene to these organizations, and they've given them a spot on campus commensurate with that. So even if there are college presidents who really are appalled by some of these stories we've heard lately, and I do believe they are, it's much more than just, oh, we might alienate some alumni if we try to rein them in.
Do you have any sense of why alumni are so drawn to remembering their fraternities and thinking of them as perhaps the best years of their lives and donating money, et cetera? Why is that bond so strong?
I think it's part of this sort of collective idea that college is the best 4 years of your life, which is, whether or not it's true, it's really, really strong in parts of culture. And having, you know, the social group that is with you all the way through is a huge part of that. I wasn't in a sorority, but I was in a kind of alternate type residential college that was set up at my alma mater, and I have the exact same relationship with that group. It's where most of my friends are from. It's the thing I most strongly identify with my undergraduate experience. I think it's natural that the university is this really big place to sort of try and find a way to break it down into a friendlier component.
And how, if you were trying to look at, there are so many fraternities all over the country, would you say that there are really widespread problems with hazing, with racism, with underage drinking and excessive drinking and accidents caused because of drinking? Do you think that the problems really are out of control, or are they minuscule?
I think they're probably somewhere in between. I know Caitlin Flanagan was just on the air with all of you. Her investigation is really fantastic and really damning and one of the better things I've read in the past couple of years about this issue. You know, I
Hello? Well, we've lost the connection, so we'll try and reestablish that and take phone calls too. Libby Nelson on the same subject with us. The question of the hour is whether or not fraternities should be banned. If you're just tuning us in, we got this idea from, well, from some comments that the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, who is a professor on the campus of UC Berkeley, he wrote a piece and expressed a view on television that college fraternities should be abolished. Calls them elitist, exclusive, and privileged, have nothing to do with higher education. They're involved with hazing, with racism, with sexual assault. The list goes on of the number of incidents, serious ones there have been. There is a fairly long list just in the last couple months. And he believes that enough is enough, and the college fraternity culture brings out the worst in people, and they should be abolished. And we're asking what you think of the answer to that question should be. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And we're just, I don't know what happened to the phone line, but we're trying to reconnect. Hour two of our program today, our guest is Erin Moore. Erin grew up in Florida, and she married a gentleman from England. She also studied in England for a while, and for the past 8 years, she and her family have been living in London, and she has been listening to the way people talk and going to the library to find out about how cultural differences and different histories are expressed in the language differences between the two countries. It's a very, very entertaining book. The title of it is That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. And Erin will be with us hour two of our program to talk about that. And we'll be taking your phone calls. I'm just going to take some phone calls now because we're having a hard time linking with our guest. Now we'll pause for a moment and try to find her and continue with the conversation. Should fraternities be abolished? Are they not good things? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we try to establish connection with our guest, we'll just take your phone calls because I'm would imagine, well, we're getting a lot of calls, so we'll have you be the guest now. Should fraternities be abolished is the question, and let's go to Carol in Oconomowoc. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I totally feel the 21 drinking age has a lot to do with this because I have six adult kids who are now over 21, but when they were all in college, their practice was to drink hard alcohol. They called it pre-gaming, getting really drunk before they went anywhere. And at these fraternity parties and house parties, there's not a bartender there kind of, you know, checking out people, make sure they're not too drunk. I think the alcohol age being 21 makes kids drink more and drink more hard liquor. And I think it really is not good for college society.
So what's the answer?
Well, when my parents were in college, they had that 3-2 beer. Like, I mean, if it was legal for kids in college to drink low alcohol content beer at frat parties, then people wouldn't get so drunk and pass out in rooms.
Mm-hmm. See, I don't understand the whole culture, Carol. I come from a family where there have been a lot of drinking problems, but and maybe it skews my perception on all of this, but I don't understand this, why it's so much a part of becoming an adult, of going to college, of being in a fraternity. I don't understand the excessive drinking. I just don't get it.
I don't understand it either, but it's a reality and it exists. So
right.
I just think that if the kids could go into bars and get beer and be watched by bartenders, it would alleviate some of the problems.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carol, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. Let's go to Ken in Peel. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks. It's always a joy to be able to come on and listen to you. I would like to agree with the abolishment of fraternities. I see no use for them in higher education, and where does it contribute? I think it distracts from the students for the real purpose they're there. And it's not only the different gatherings that these fraternities have, but the abuse that they do to each other out of belonging. And then just recently you said about the drinking. Absolutely, drinking is way out of control. I think that universities should have more control over their students and how they drink, both at fraternities, on or off campus. Where are we teaching them the dangers of all of this, and what does it really have to do with the education they're there for? Mm.
Ken, do you think that we're sending young people off to college at too young an age?
Yes, I think so, too. They barely have experience enough with being outside of the home, and high school does not give them the experience that they're going to have going into college. I know when I think back for myself, but recently for my daughter, when she went to college, thank God she chose not to belong to any of that stuff, that her purpose was for one reason, and that was to get the education. And she worked hard at that, but did not join any of that kind of stuff. But she even admitted at the beginning that it was quite a change from high school to college. And even in college, the high school prep did not give her the experience of what she'd have to have to go into the actual college environment.
Thank you very much for the call. I guess that's another point. It may be, and one of the guests suggested in her article in The Atlantic that maybe we should look at whether or not we should send students off to university when they're 18 years old, or if a community college making a transition more gradually would make more sense, because it is understandable that if you're with a group of people, if you're in a fraternity particularly, or maybe a sorority where there isn't a lot of oversight as to what's going on, and where you have a culture, you know, that's being established by people who are 18 years old or 19 years old, you may not have the best culture, right? Now that there aren't some 18-year-olds who are perfectly capable of putting together a wonderful culture, but in many cases, that's not the case. So maybe there are many questions that are involved with this. Should fraternities be abolished is the question of the hour. We have lost our guests, so you are our guests right now. And let's go next to Allison in Green Bay. Hi, Allison.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Thanks for taking my call. I am a relatively recent college graduate. I finished my undergrad about 5 years ago, and I was in a sorority at a small private college, a little bit different from the large public universities. We've seen a lot of the fraternity scandals, if you will, in recent news. We, unfortunately, before I attended there, had a really sad tragedy where we did have a drinking death that was not necessarily linked to a fraternity, but took place in the house of the fraternity, and it was a member who was a new pledging member. And ever since that happened, the university has really taken a strong oversight stance within the Greek housing especially, and they've actually mandated that an independent, usually grad assistant, actually has to live in the house as sort of a live-in RA, but that's an adult, not a student, and not a member of that organization. And they've really stepped up the rules as far as what's allowed in houses. Many national Greek life organizations actually mandate whether or not the organization is dry. And it comes down to kind of where there's two entities at work at the same time. A lot of times residence life may operate different rules for students who are 21, or whether or not all dorms are dry. So I think in that case, we need to have a little bit more cooperation between national organizations and the local college or university staff. I think it's kind of a hands-off attitude where each one relies on the other to take care of it, and it doesn't necessarily happen that anyone addresses it. But being a member of Greek life, I did feel that it was a positive addition to my experience, and I didn't really notice that drinking was any more present in a fraternity or sorority atmosphere than it was with any other undergraduate student.
Thank you for your call. Libby is with us again. Would you like, I think you heard what she said. Libby, you want to respond?
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that, by the way. I don't know what happened to my phone, but it's never happened before. I think, you know, it depends a lot on the culture of the college, and certainly drinking and other risky behaviors wouldn't go away without the Greek system. A lot of it, I think, is the culture that's created within individual chapters and within individual campuses. You know, there can be places where really drinking is even less of an influence than it might be out in the broader culture, but then there are also chapters that sort of egg each other on, and certainly you can't say that every Greek organization is the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is something very judgmental about the whole system. It is kind of strange, isn't it, that you pledge a fraternity and people talk about whether or not you can be a member of their group, or if you're an outsider to the group and you wait and see whether or not you've been accepted. It's rather exclusionary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's an exclusionary system sort of by definition, or at least in that it is about picking the people you want to associate yourself with. And, you know, that's a natural sociological thing, to want to be with other people who are like you. But it also is, and it's something that happens, you know, in other student groups as well, but probably not as explicitly as it does in Greek life. The situation at the University of Alabama a couple of years ago, where a very well-qualified African-American young woman rushed and was not chosen by any sorority, is sort of the extreme example of that.
Paul sends this email, fraternities may personify the problem, but anyone thinking that it is limited to them is denying a problem that, as far as I can tell, now well into my 40s, we all grew up with right before our eyes. The conversation needs to be much broader and deeper than just the Greek houses, although they are a starting point.
I think that's absolutely true. The Chronicle of Higher Education wrote a great piece earlier this year on why colleges can't do more to control binge drinking. Certainly you hear about a lot of problems with sexual assault within fraternities, but there are statistics that show that women in sororities are more likely to report sexual assault than women who are not in sororities, but that is not a problem limited to the Greek system either. And it sort of gets back to this central question that I think we're really wrestling with in higher education, which is, are students adults who are making their own choices and who take responsibility or suffer the consequences totally for those choices? Or does the college have sort of an obligation to ensure that they're not running up against some of the hard edges of life that they might otherwise be if they're not enrolled in college?
Mm-hmm. Well, 18 is still fairly young, isn't it? You can go off to college at 18 years old and not be very mature and get yourself in a place where there isn't much oversight and trouble may ensue.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting points somebody made when I was reporting the story was from a professor in Kentucky who had studied fraternities specifically on his campus. And he said he noticed that even the older guys were sort of aging out of it, that the culture was really dominated by 18, 19, 20-year-old guys who were often living in a house together or very involved in these activities with absolutely no supervision whatsoever. And he said, you know, we wouldn't allow that with our athletes. We wouldn't allow that with other groups of students on campus. It's kind of a recipe for breeding undesirable behavior in some ways.
We have a few more minutes left. Should we be abolishing fraternities is the question this hour. The suggestion came, well, I'm sure it's been made before, but an interesting TV appearance, and he's been getting a lot of response to what he had to say from former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, who said it's time for them to be abolished. He says he's been getting angry responses to the view that he expressed on Larry Wilmore's The Nightly Show that college fraternities should be abolished, but he says, yeah, I still think that I'm right. There are exceptions, but for the most part, fraternities are elitist, exclusive, and privileged. They have nothing to do with higher education, and they are mired periodically in scandal, hazing, racism, sexual assault, allegations of drug dealing, and degradation of women. The list goes on. This is just in the last few months, he says, and it's time for us to get rid of them. What do you think? Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to send a message that way, is talk@WPR.org. And we go to Sophia in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Sophia.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Well, I think it's so interesting because I think we have such an opportunity with fraternities and sororities to create really safe parties that can be more supervised than others are, but we're not using that because we're letting fraternities and sororities kind of dictate themselves. And I think if we're not going to abolish fraternities and sororities, we need to radically change our views of them. People wanting to pledge to sororities and fraternities shouldn't be thinking, this is where I'm going to go to party, this is where I'm going to go to, like, drink and drugs and sex. We should, you know, view it as
this is a community within my college where it's going to be more supervised and it's going to be safer. If I do want a party, we should institute more regulations within these groups.
Libby?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one interesting pattern you see when you look at how colleges relate to Greek life and to other student organizations sometimes as well is that they make decisions that are in their best interest legally, but may not be in the best interest of the students. So you see things like making the Greek houses dry and therefore ensuring that all of the parties are going to happen off campus or where there, you know, is no chance of supervision. And some people who study this say, you know, these could be an opportunity to sort of actually enrich the educational experience, but that requires holding them to a standard that is higher than, as somebody memorably put it to me, you know, don't kill anybody, don't get anybody assaulted, and you can stick around.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we're seeing more and more interest among young people to pledge a fraternity or a sorority? Why are they stronger now?
You know, they're definitely stronger now than they were a generation ago. It's hard to say. I think it's partly just sort of looking for a sense of community on campus. I think part of this is sort of a cultural feedback loop where fraternities and sororities and their behavior are a really popular topic in pop culture. And especially where fraternities are concerned, it all sort of creates this norm of what we expect people in fraternities to be doing and a kind of behavior we expect from them. And so I think it's, you know, and it's fun. It's there's a sense of fellowship. There's an easy way to meet people. Colleges can be a really big and alienating place. And I think in some way it may just be searching for a sense of engagement.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Sophia. Michael in Madison. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Well, this whole conversation is rather laughable because the fraternities or sororities are easy to be whipped upon and demand that they be moral institutions when the culture of the United States itself is immoral. Mr. Wright worked for a president who was committing adultery in the White House and said that, well, there's public morality and private morality. It's nonsense. At the University of Wisconsin, they've been housing men and women together in their dormitories for years now. And that's absurd. You can't argue on both sides of the issue. Lying is still lying. Fornication is still fornication. So you've got just as much sexual depravity among the people that run the university as you do among the students, because the culture of the United States is such.
Libby.
You know, I think there is an argument that college culture is reflected in fraternities and the culture of individual campuses. And that's why you can sort of see Greek life vary so much from place to place. But I also think there are really more extreme examples coming out of Greek organizations than we're seeing elsewhere. And that's important because of the prominence they're given within campus culture and within student government and within the university itself.
And thanks for the call. We have time for maybe one more call. Edward in, or no, I guess it's Carolyn. Hi, Carolyn in Heartland.
Hi. I wanted to say that my son belonged to a fraternity in Whitewater, Lambda Chi Alpha, and I can't even begin to tell you how fabulous an experience he had. His dad died. All these young men showed up at the funeral, were the ushers, everything. When he went and graduated and had his art exhibit, all these guys came and supported him and the work that he was doing, and he did the same thing. They had big food drives, everything. And yes, they were immature sometimes, not like we hear about Virginia and things like that,
mm-hmm.
but it helped him become the person that he is today, and he's a really fine guy. That's all I wanted to say.
All right, Carolyn, thanks very much for the call. And Libby, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you as well. It was a pleasure.
Libby Nelson, she writes an article, Colleges Depend on Greek Life, That's Why It's So Hard to Control, that appeared in Vox. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. If you didn't get a chance to be on the air, we welcome your comments on Facebook as well. They're always interesting to read. Our show is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and write your comments. We'll read them after we're off the air, and people may comment on what you have to say as well. Next hour of the program, That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. It's a really fun book, so we will learn some new words, maybe pick up some British phrases, or find out why there are differences in interpretation.